From the Sky News Centre at 5, 16 NHS organisations in England are experiencing major IT problems because of a cyber attack. Their systems have been infected by ransomware, which locks files until you pay money to the hackers. Our reporter John Craig is outside the Department of Health.
I've just been speaking to a senior source here who tells me that Jeremy Hunt, the Health Secretary, is, as we speak, being briefed on this crisis. He's obviously talking to people in NHS England. NHS Digital.
There are reports of some hospitals cancelling appointments and diverting ambulances. Sean Linton from the Health Service Journal has been sent a screenshot of what's apparently coming up on NHS PCs.
We have actually seen the image that some users are seeing on their computers, which demands a $300 worth of Bitcoin to be paid within the next 3 days. And if they don't, the NHS will lose its files, etc.
The health service says it wasn't the only target of the attack, as organisations from a range of sectors are affected. The parents of a boy who died following an allergic reaction after a school dinner in East London are accusing staff of failing in their duty of care. A coroner has been told Nasir Ahmed wasn't given an adrenaline injection quick enough. The school says staff are already getting more training. Jeremy Corbyn says he accepts military action under international law and as a genuine last resort. He's been discussing defence and foreign policy on the election campaign today. Theresa May's warning a Labour government would be an economic disaster. Donald Trump has taken to Twitter to warn the FBI director he sacked over media leaks. The US president says James Comey better hope there are no tapes of their conversations. And a man who found the richest collection of rare Viking artefacts ever found in the UK is in line to get almost £2 million as a reward. Derek McLenning uncovered the 10th century hoard in a Dumfries and Galloway field in 2014. That's the latest. I'm Victoria Lawrence.
It's Friday. It's 5 o'clock. Welcome to BCFM's Politics Show. Gosling helping me review this week's news. It's former Sunday Times Rich List journalist, author of Who Owns Britain, Kevin Carhill, and Mike Campbell from Protect Our NHS. After the 6 o'clock news, a nationwide sweep of German army barracks as serving soldiers are discovered with Nazi memorabilia. Meanwhile, an arrested German soldier planned to blame his own terror attack on Syrian refugees. Also, the rich list is out again, but what planet are the super rich on? And when caring for people doesn't make money, but ripping us off does, how do the banks decide who's going to get that £1 million loan and who isn't? Talking of the banks and the banksters, former Rothschild banker Emmanuel Macron is the next French president. Like the US election, are the French people being given the choice between a fascist or neoliberal nutcase warmonger when they don't want either? And North Korea's in the news again. The US puts its THAAD missile system in. Have you seen South Korean protests in our news? And is THAAD just a defensive system? If so, what's the problem? We also look at this week's South Korean elections and ask, is there any real danger in threats by Kim Jong-il and Donald Trump to start a nuclear war, or is it all just saber-rattling? Plus Martin Summers' chance to take us on a tour of the world's hotspots, and Kevin's too, in the second hour after six. On to our news review in a minute, but first, Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. Tonight, lows of 11 Celsius and showers this weekend, highs of 16. Tomorrow, we mainly dry with sunny spells. Sunday, a mixture of sunshine and showers. Goodness, the garden and the farmers could do without rain, couldn't they? Let's hope that it's as forecast, because next week, highs of 18 Celsius, plenty of showers, and some of them heavy, also sunny spells. Next weekend, that's the 20th and 21st of May, highs of 16, sunshine and showers again next weekend. That was Bristol's two-weekend weather forecast from theweatheroutlook.com. So helping us review this week's news are former Sunday Times Rich List journalist and author of Who Owns Britain, Kevin Carhill, also Mike Campbell from Protect Our NHS. Hello, both of you, and welcome to the Politics Show.
Hi there.
Thank you.
Kevin, let's just start with you, because your rich list, I think when this comes out, I'm always very, very sceptical about it. I can remember a few years ago down at some conference I was at in Totnes, opening a copy of the Rich List, Sunday Times colour supplement, which used to be worth reading in the old days with war photography. People like Don McCullen, for example, his photos from war zones around the world in there. Now it's all sort of lifestyle stuff. But the Rich List was there, and on the second page of the Rich List, surreptitiously on the side of the newspaper, was an advert, which you never normally see in the newspapers, for Rothschild wine. Now, interesting, I think, that some people are so rich, it seems, that they can avoid being on the Rich List at all.
I don't think so, not while Philip Beresford was running it. You really couldn't get off it. If he could find your assets, you were on it. There were loads of people who tried to get him to take them off, and that included the palace. For the first 7 years, the Queen was at the top of the list, not, as the paper now says, because of her art collection. She was on the top of the list because of the Crown estate, which she does own. So her valuation of 300-odd million is a bit ridiculous.
Okay, so, well, look, sorry, before you carry on there, just give us some examples of the sorts of ways it was possible for the super rich to contact the Sunday Times and get themselves either vastly removed down the list or removed completely, because they're really embarrassed about the amount of wealth they had.
Well, let's start with the Queen. The palace phoned Murdoch. It was that simple. But in the first Rich List, it was really quite funny. Sullivan, you know, the pornographer, got really miffed, and he sent us his accounts. Then there was a Tory MP, the chap who owned Velcro. Don't remember his name. But he wrote a really hostile letter saying he'd sue and everything. But Phil and I had fixed it. You can't be sued for saying somebody is worth a lot of money. So he missed. But this guy was in three different tax havens. You know, he had the company in one, the shares in the next, and the administration in Jersey. And he was a member of Parliament, and not the first. So there are various ways, but most of the approaches were by people who wanted themselves put further up the list.
Okay, vanity, really. So what have you taken from this most recent list? What do you make of it?
Well, it's really interesting. Almost everybody on the top of the list, the first 10, have their assets in tax havens. The second thing, only one of the 10 is Brit-born. This seems to be a wonderful country for people to come from, you know, India and all sorts of places, and really make it here.
Well, that's one of the things I remember from being in Singapore, is they were saying, well, if you're actually living a resident and on a Singapore passport, it's impossible to avoid tax here. But if you're from abroad, fine.
Yeah. But it's
is that just a way of sort of bringing money into the country from abroad? Is that what many of these legal jurisdictions, I mean, places like Panama, Switzerland and Britain do?
Well, there's our own little collection. It's fundamentally, nobody seems to understand why the United Kingdom runs the largest group of tax havens, because what the people leaving their assets there do is strip this country of tax. And it would take very little to stop it. But Gordon Brown tried. Gordon Brown had a lovely phrase to me. He said, I'm going to turn the tax havens back into holiday resorts. And he did try. And the people who stopped him dead were the Americans, because so many American millionaires are in tax havens.
Mike?
Yes, I think that for me, what's most fascinating and about this Rich List, and I try and look at it every year, because it casts a kind of glimpse of what is happening and how the wealthy are actually getting ever richer. And I was looking at some figures that showed, and Kevin might be able to confirm this, that the top 100 in the Rich List this year have increased their wealth by about 14% over the last year. And I thought that actually from an NHS perspective, thinking about nurses who have had a real wage cut of around 14%, for me that shows a stark issue of inequality. And I think the more people are aware of that rich list, and Kevin is absolutely right, the numbers of the wealthy who use tax havens, that includes many NHS private providers who squirrel away money, having made a profit from the NHS, in tax havens. And Richard Branson, who I think must be still in the top 10, I think he certainly has been in the top 10 or top 20. So Richard Branson, who runs the Virgin organisation and Virgin Care, is one of those who is making money from the NHS and also putting his money into a tax haven.
His money has always been in tax havens. One of the early stories I ran after I left the Sunday Times was about Branson, and he blew up. We were cut dead. But Branson has always kept his money in places like Jersey and that island of his in Mystique. So his assets are not here.
I mean, you know, you're saying that almost all of the top 10 in the rich list have got their assets in tax havens. I mean, is it simply that the government doesn't want to upset these people because they're wealthy? They're obviously employers. Why is it? What is this correlation between tax havens and being super rich? Is it that simple that if you keep your money in tax havens, it's much easier to become super rich?
If the top end of the Sunday Times rich list were forced to base their assets here in the United Kingdom, they would suffer at least a 50% cut in their wealth. Capital gains tax.
Mike, you mentioned Richard Branson doing Virgin Care, obviously competing with the NHS, keeping his money in tax havens. Are there any of the other providers of private health care? I mean, there are some big ones, aren't there?
We've done, Protector NHS has done a bit of research on national and local providers in the private sector who provide health and social care services. And I can just mention three local providers who have a national identity. One is Care UK, who run Emerson's Green. Care UK are now not listed on the stock exchange. They are owned by a company called Bridgepoint, which is a private equity company. And we know that Care UK have done deals around their properties that has reduced their tax liability. Four Seasons Healthcare, a company that's owned by a group of men who are based in the Channel Islands, is another one. They provide massive social care services across the country. And actually, one of the issues around tax havens is that a lot of people are not aware that some of these companies are very fragile economically, financially. They're not sound, robust companies. And Four Seasons Healthcare is one. We've already mentioned Virgin Care, and there are others. You know, there are others. Boots, one of the biggest private providers of pharmacy services, running GP services, moved its headquarters from Nottingham a number of years ago to Switzerland. Now, why do you move your headquarters where you declare your profits from one country to another, like Switzerland? You do it because it's going to be easier on your financial burden. You can save money.
Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers, does sound as if there's a correlation here. The privatisation of these various, we're just hearing about health here. That sort of privatisation, you're talking about kind of selling it off to people who are not even prepared to pay tax here in Britain. I mean, what can possibly be the benefit of privatising these national services when so much of the public money that's being spent is then being squirreled away abroad and is not... I mean, this isn't illegal, apparently, although some of it may be. We don't know necessarily, because the money's not being declared. But it seems quite an irresponsible thing to do, to privatise something, when it means that it's just going to simply nourish private companies and send them up the rich list.
Well, of course, what happens is that once you've actually privatised a public service, you've then created a corporate welfare queen. And, of course, that's the way to make money, is to supply weaponry, for example, to the US government on cost-plus contracts. You know, building a better widget, that's not really what it's about. Can I just come back to the question of legality and illegality? Because, of course, as Kevin will point out, this is all based on assets which are traceable and which people can see. Now, for many years, it was presumed, although nobody was able to prove, that Pablo Escobar was probably one of the richest people in the planet. And, of course, he didn't appear in the rich list because he was...
He was a drug kingpin in Colombia.
And, of course, Pablo Escobar's son was quoted in the Colombian press last month saying, well, his father worked with the CIA for years and years and years. So we're only even, when we're talking about the rich list and so on, we're talking only about the visible economy. There's an invisible illegal economy which is also enmeshed. Because the CIA, of course, is a public bureaucracy, etc. So we've pretty much got it. I mean, as Oxfam pointed out not long ago, the small minority of people at the top of the tree on the planet now own far more in assets than the bottom 50% of population of the planet.
Just to pick up on this whole sort of illegal drug dealing on an international scale business, Martin, is Roberto Saviano, the author of this book, Zero, Zero, Zero. Yeah. He's explaining essentially that there's a close continuity between multinational corporations and the narco cartels, that they are now beginning to model themselves, people like HSBC Bank, on the narco cartels, knowing that, for example, they can quite easily break the law because none of the senior executives will go to jail. They will just be given a piffling fine compared to the amount of extra money they've made by becoming criminals.
Well, it's a very interesting book because he points out that the narco cartels are at the cutting edge of corporate innovation. And, of course, it's not that... There's now no real difference between the mainstream banking system, which has been bailed out by the taxpayer all over the world, and the narco cartels. They're all absolutely embedded. In 2009, the UN Office on Drugs and Crime came out with a report, mostly written by police officers, which pointed out that without the money from the narco cartels, the banking system would have collapsed, even with taxpayer support. So we're now, you know, this is the world we're now living in, the world that Theresa May is defending as she goes into this January 8th election with her hedge fund husband.
Well, it's well worth looking, I think, at the other end of the scale. I mean, but the super rich does seem, you know, for many of us, well, for almost all of us, this is a million miles away. It's another planet, effectively. At the other end of the scale, Bristol's Volunteer Centre is closed this week. It's on Vosker's website, the voluntary sector. It says, it is with great regret that Vosker announces Bristol's Volunteer Centre will be closing on the 10th of May 2017. Continue to support local social action by providing a regular volunteer organisers forum and good practice resources. However, Volunteer Bristol's drop-in facility at Royal Oak House will close after its last day on the 10th of May. That's this week. Vosker's chief executive, Wendy Stevenson, I did actually approach her for an interview, but she didn't get back to me, said, volunteering is changing. Increasingly, people are looking for different ways of getting and offering help in their communities. But, of course, you know, the reality of it is that this volunteer centre is actually really important. In fact, you're getting quite regularly people being referred by all sorts of services to the volunteer service, saying, you know, in order to stop you going crazy at home, basically, it's a good idea to spend a part of your week volunteering doing something. It's also a way to build up your CV, etc. And now, of course, that's being effectively transferred online. Mike, let's just ask you a little bit about this, because this volunteer centre opened in 1966 and it closed this week.
I mean, I think this is for me. This is one of the examples of the impact of cuts. I mean, I think it goes without saying that if a centre like this, which does really valuable work and is aimed at more vulnerable communities as well, does valuable work and helped by local authorities, and then funds are cut, then it's going to be the people who receive those services who are going to be most affected. And I think it's interesting, 1966, the Volunteer Centre opened. Before I started my career in the public sector, I was a volunteer. That was how I got into and gained some experience of the public sector by doing volunteer work. And there are thousands of young people all over Bristol who are going to miss out without there being some central referral point where people can go and say, look, I want to do a bit of volunteering. I want to help people in my street. I want to help people who are vulnerable, young people. So it's a tragedy. And I think that I'm going back to what we were saying earlier. What I feel really angry about is that as these services are cut, you read the Sunday Times rich list and realise that there are some people who are getting richer within this austerity programme at the moment, which is a reason why I think that we need to think, people need to think very clearly about how they're going to vote on June the 8th. And perhaps we'll talk later about the whole issue of registering to vote, because I think people who don't normally vote this election must look at themselves, look into themselves and decide, actually, we need to vote for this election. And I can talk about the NHS and the issues there later.
Well, look, I know Protect Our NHS is actually running a meeting of some sort next week during the sort of pre-election period. So let's what are you up to? Because I think for many of us, there's something pretty horrific about watching the NHS kind of going down onto its knees. We just heard yesterday about the record waiting lists, the horrific increase in the waiting times for cancer treatment, which of course can easily mean life or death for people, and also debunking of these regular figures that we hear from Theresa May and Jeremy Hunt about the extra money, the extra $10 billion apparently that they've been spending on the NHS, those figures being debunked as well. So we've, you know, almost every day we're seeing more and more of a kind of struggle to control the narrative of what's really happening to the NHS.
And I think in Bristol and across the country there are campaigners who are actually saying, don't believe the Tory Conservative lies about that the NHS is safe in their hands. It is not. And we can give some facts. And yes, Tony, you've rightly pointed out at the moment that that we at the moment the largest number of people, highest number of people on record waiting on waiting lists for urgent cancer treatment. We have now hip and cataract operations, really quite regular procedures. 4 million people are now waiting for those kind of operations. We have an A&E departments across the country that are actually in crisis. 100% of the time are in crisis. 15,000 beds, hospital beds, have been lost over the last 6 years. GPs are finding it more... I'm sure your listeners will probably say to themselves, actually, it is more difficult to get an appointment with a GP. We've lost 400 fewer GPs in the last year. Nurses, I mentioned earlier, are on a 1% pay cap. They could, and we heard Theresa May saying, oh, the reasons why nurses are going to food banks are complicated. It's not complicated. They don't have enough money. And I think if people, and the meeting on Thursday, it's the Trinity Centre, Thursday evening, is looking at how do you save the NHS from Theresa May and Donald Trump. I can talk a little bit about Donald Trump shortly, but essentially it's about getting people to think about what is happening to the NHS. We will be giving lots of information. It will be a very lively debate with national and local speakers, including a local GP. We'll be giving information to people about what is really happening to the NHS and what they can do about it.
Kevin, I suppose I also ought to ask you about this topic, because so the health service is an incredibly important part of government service, and it seems it's being eroded. I'm sure the Conservatives will say they've been spending more, but there's no dispute that the effect of this is that the service is deteriorating rapidly.
Yeah, but the problem, and I think it's coming up, there are some people who are able to tell the public what's going on, but then they are counteracted, and it's the media is doing it. The media is totally ineffective. It doesn't confront people like Theresa May when she said we spent 10 million when she hasn't.
$10 billion, apparently.
$10 billion, yeah. And the other party is Parliament. The opposition is totally ineffective. She gets up and she says things which on a different topic, which I know are not true. And nobody challenges her. You know, there's a failure in two. The public hear what they hear through the media. And I think the media has an awful lot. Well, why? What a surprise. The Daily Mail is held in Bermuda or the Bahamas. The Telegraph is owned on one of the islands off Jersey.
It's actually, yeah, it's off Sark. Place,
yeah.
Martin and I have been there. You can even see us on online if you want to. A little island called Brecu, which is off the island, same side of Sark, and they've got this kind of mock Gothic castle that the Barclay twins live in there, and they bring in their Malaysian workers every day from Guernsey, and then they go back to Guernsey. They have very little to do with Sark other than trying to control the parliament and take it over and failing.
Yep.
So,
but there is this vested and total conflict of interest. Some of Richard Desmond's, The Express, some of his stuff is offshore. Murdoch,
who also owns Channel 5 as well, by the way.
Yeah.
Who have been doing some filming in Bristol recently of on the side of bailiffs evicting people, showing what a terrible time the poor bailiffs have when they evict people. So that's Richard Desmond and his Channel 5 programmes. Yeah. But anyway, Kevin, another thing is we've heard today on the news, we can't not talk about this obvious thing in the news today about the apparent hacking of the NHS computers. That seems a sort of cyber attack of some kind, it sounds like.
Yeah, well, if you like, sometimes I sound blasé because the American government has been convicted in a high court and then the highest court in Europe of spying on us. And what's anybody done? Nothing. You know, and the NHS is a prime target. You've seen the arrangement the NHS has made with one of the hospitals in London. And they're being given patients' data with no controls. This is Google's DeepMind project. And it's just data theft. And they want the data so they can manipulate the public. I don't know why it's so difficult to get that concept across.
But in what way do they want to manipulate the public?
You know what a person has been thinking and doing and you have it on a file and you can analyse it, you can then predict what they will do and you can predict their vulnerabilities.
I suppose
what it's all about.
If there was ever a kind of Gestapo force in the world, that's the sort of information they would love, wasn't
yeah.
it? This also, though, looking at this hack attack, I've been getting a lot of things through my door recently, almost like every week, about smart meters. I'm sure other people around the city have as well. And I've just taking a look this week at some of the problems with these smart meters. We're being told they're wonderful, they're smart, and if you don't have one, obviously you must be stupid. But if you do a little bit of digging online, you'll find I'll put a few links to these articles up on our show page. Actually, the Daily Mail's done quite a good job in digging up some of the dangers of these smart meters. For example, even an energy boss admits smart meters aren't that smart. The boss of EDF says in an £11 billion plan to introduce them nationally is facing what he calls many challenges. That's Vincent de Rivaz, the chief executive of EDF Energy. He was critical of the quality of the meters actually being sold and offered to customers. Apparently it is your choice. I think that's pretty strong advice is not to have one of these things, because GCHQ is stepping in over a fear that the 11 billion smart meters being installed in millions of homes may be hacked, leading to gas supplies being cut off. Once the battery stops working, the meter just shuts the gas off in the so-called smart meter. Technology experts also say the meters can be controlled remotely through Wi-Fi signals. So someone can come and hack your meter and switch off your gas, which despite security measures could mean hackers are able to turn off the supply. The national smart meter rollout, apparently £11 billion it's going to add to our energy bills. So for every one of those smart meters we use, that's a massive addition to the energy bills. Also, scientists are calling for protection from the ill health effects of cell phones, Wi-Fi and smart meters. And finally, Colin Fernandez, science correspondent in the Daily Mail, says how smart meters can give readings that are seven times too high because of dimmer switches and LED bulbs confuse these devices. There was SSE Energy had to apologise to customers earlier this week, that is in March this year, after malfunctioning smart meters handed customers bills for as much as £44,000 a day. So not that smart.
No, and I mean, the other danger is that they are a spy in the home, which is a real danger. You know, it's all part of this collecting mass data.
Also, Martin, it's like newspeak, this, isn't it? Smart meter. Be smart. Have a smart meter. Of course, actually, what it all it means is that you can potentially be more vulnerable.
Mm. Well, you can. And, of course, anybody who's been involved in attempting to subvert the state or whatever would recognise immediately you shouldn't possibly... You don't want to be under any
electronic surveillance at all. The government is behind this, even though it means that, you know, you could have the mass shutting down through hacking of millions of people's energy supplies.
Mm-hmm. Well, yes, and we're also talking... You know, we're talking, of course, you know, we're talking about the Russians might hack our elections and so
but
on.
But this is...
Quite absurd.
Can I come in there? That is... it's beyond a joke because it's serious. The government is spending $20 million on a national cybersecurity centre in London. And the first question they got from me was a really simple one. I said, how do I protect myself from PRISM? I haven't heard from them since. PRISM is the American surveillance system that has been proven in court, you know, judged, convicted of mass surveillance of us and our children. And nothing's been done.
Well, you want to say something, Mike?
Yeah,
this is Mike. Sorry, just to remind listeners, this is Protecting NHS's Mike Campbell.
One of the bits of work I was doing a couple of years ago was looking at how what was called then the Health and Social Care Information Centre was organised. Now, the Health and Social Care Information Centre was rebranded last year as NHS Digital, and it's NHS Digital that have been hacked today. And NHS Digital is actually influenced by and has a number of private companies managing the data that it holds, and that data really is very basic. It includes health records, and there is a very clear reason, or possibly two clear reasons, why somebody would want to hack into NHS Digital. One is to just disrupt, and we don't know why, disrupt the system. The other is to garner data, health, and the reason people would like data on our records is that it provides information for health insurance companies. And Kevin is quite right. The deal that was done for a large area in London, our records, our health records, were sold. And the reason they were sold is because if large insurance providers, and they're mainly American, get hold of that information, then they can start to focus their services, because they're often providers of services, on those on those people who are vulnerable because of their health and health needs.
They could also refuse you health insurance, couldn't they, for example, if they've got some data on you?
Absolutely.
And also, well worth mentioning, I think, this data mining business. You think to yourself, well, who would need that and why? Well, I'll tell you who would need it and why. Somebody called Peter Thiel, who's the founder of Facebook originally. He's now the owner of PayPal. He also owns another company called Palantir. Now, Palantir is from the Lord of the Rings, which is these kind of crystal ball things that people use to talk to each other. But Palantir offers a service to governments saying, we will profile your population and help you to run your country. And a lot of governments are starting to buy into this massive network of data mined assistance to help you run things, Kevin.
Yeah, no. In the United Kingdom, based on the court records, the first company into that was Microsoft in September 2007. In 2009, it has to have been the Prime Minister. Nobody else could give the authority. GCHQ were authorised to run the American surveillance system against people in Britain. And alongside that, it had to be the Prime Minister again, accepted a donation of £100 million from the National Security Agency. What for? This has never been explained.
It's a bit like a bribe, maybe.
Well, it looks like a bribe to me.
Martin, what do you make of all this data mining? What's your thoughts on it?
Well, I mean, the purpose of it, before modern computers, if you collected this amount of information on the population, you wouldn't be able to use it. You know, when in the days of card files, people would have to listen to all of to listen to telephone intercepts and so on. But now they can analyse big data. and I've seen, you know, mainstream people like Facebook saying, look, we just by looking at the words people are using on Facebook, we can predict what their mood is, and they show how on rainy days their mood goes down, and when the sun comes out their mood goes up. All of it's very important for targeted marketing, but also very important for control of the population. And of course, the individuals that are important, having their data mined, is very important. You know, so that you can show that, you know, somebody accessed a porn site or whatever, who was standing for Parliament, and they can be embarrassed and so, or blackmailed or what have you. And this kind of total control is coming, and that's why they want it. I mean, we've got to be clear about what this is about.
Well, it's one of the things that worries me about this sort of apparent coming police state is where lawyers can be banned and murder charges overturned, and that's what's happened over the last couple of weeks with this chap Marine A. Apparently his killing of an Afghan who shot him dead, basically, this Afghan guy over in Afghanistan when he was a serving soldier. The evidence is all there, it's all presented. You've shot him dead, you've committed murder, he's now being let off. And it just amazes me that this kind of thing can happen. But it's also Phil Scheiner, who's the lawyer that brought the case, has also been struck off. This is really, it seems to me, making an example, almost a kind of punishment of Phil Scheiner for making this successful
conviction. I think that's more worrying to me than the fact that this guy has been let off. He hasn't been completely let off. I mean, he has been in prison for a while.
Well, he's served time, hasn't he?
He's served some time, and he's taken...
No, he's carrying the conviction.
He's carrying the conviction. So, in other words, I think there was a lobby saying that, what he did is he shot this guy dead. It was a local insurgent. And he said, and of course it was filmed by his co-soldier. And ultimately, you see, if you go to war in a country like Afghanistan, you're going to have to pay the price, and you're going to have to recognise that some people are going to get killed, and some people are going to do wrong things and have to go to prison for 25 years. You might be better off not going at all.
It strikes me as rather similar to the murder of the Palestinian guy and the Israeli Defence Forces soldier who shot him dead, who was also then convicted of murder, I believe, recently. Similar sort of case. There's clear video evidence that someone has unprovoked killed somebody on film. And yet there seems to be lots of shenanigans, lots of efforts to try and make sure that they don't have to do time for it. Particularly, I think, by sending a very clear message to the lawyers through striking off a successful conviction, the lawyers behind a successful... Anyway, let's have a listen now. I'll ask all three of you what you make of this. This is an interview which was done with Soldier A, really talking about how he feels now he's a free man.
Hey, I'll shut off and call you. Nothing he would do to us.
No.
If you look at that video, it would seem plain to everyone that you knew what you were doing.
It's a 5-minute section of an incident that took well over an hour. And to be fair, you can put quite a few different spins on what's said. And unless you were actually there, you don't know the full story.
Hindsight is a wonderful thing, and given especially what's happened to us in our life, if you could go back, you would change things.
If he had a time machine and could go back and do things differently, he absolutely would.
You lost a lot of colleagues and friends.
Yeah, it's hard, and I think, you know, one of the hardest things I found is, and I think I've said it before, is, you know, you don't get to give a lot of good news to people when you're out there in a position of command. You know, it's, you know, someone's died in an incident, and then what would normally be a really bad piece of news to follow is, but you're given it as a plus, is, oh, this guy's lost a leg, but he's going to live.
Blackman's conviction for murder led to protests. His wife, Claire, led the campaign for his release, but her husband had offered her the chance to walk away from their marriage.
I said if she didn't want to stick around or wanted to part company, at that point, or at any point throughout the process, it would be something I'd understand, and I'd sort of wish her well for the rest of her life.
So you were basically offering her the chance to walk away?
Yes.
Never crossed my mind. Never once. Wouldn't have done anything differently. I mean, I know sometimes people said to me, how are you doing this? How do you keep going? I don't really have an answer, but it wasn't an option to do anything else.
It's only 11 days since he was released from prison. Now, they both say they need time to readjust to life as a couple. In 7 years of marriage, they've been apart more than they've been together. Clinton Rogers, BBC News, Somerset.
So there you go, Clinton Rogers' report from the BBC. But Kevin, you're a former army officer and a journalist. What do you make of this?
This is very tricky because, I'm an ex-serviceman. And the rules of war, if you like, are laid down in Queen's regulations, and you cannot transfer civilian law to a military situation. There are rules in Queen's regulations that would have classed that as at least manslaughter. But things happen. We train people to go out and kill people, and we must expect things to go wrong. And you have to have a system that works as best as can, given that shooting people dead is murder, whether you do it on the orders of government or not.
But what when it's the person, say, for example, presenting no threat, surrendered, whatever?
This one was apparently on his way out. But it doesn't work like that. If you've been under fire and some of your mates have been hit, and, you know, that's not a normal situation. You should never have been in it in the first place.
Martin, what do you make of the coverage of this story?
Well, I think I'd take on what Kevin's saying there. I mean, when soldiers do... I mean, I think the guy himself recognises that he shouldn't have done it. This is a local boy who's fighting to defend his community. Who's the brave one here? You, who've just walked in here from local terms is a massive salary, and you've been shot at a little bit, and you've lost your temper and shot somebody dead who you didn't have to shoot dead. That local boy's a hero. He's a hero to his brothers. And of course, what the fella's doing, who shot that little boy, who is, you know, 18, 19, is all his brothers are now going to join the Taliban, and the British Army are going to take even more crap than they took before. That's the problem with getting involved in these kind of battles. What's even more important, of course, is the senior officers involved in terrorist actions. And I would like to mention, as I always do in this context, Brigadier Gordon Kerr, the head of the Force Research Unit in Northern Ireland, who, as was shown on Panorama 18 months ago, the Northern Ireland ombudswoman on the police ombudswoman, Nuro Lone, said, we've now got evidence that the Force Research Unit was involved in hundreds of murders in Northern Ireland. Bombings, shootings, assassinations. Hundreds.
Okay, there's a general
Brigadier
election.
Gordon Kerr?
There's a general election coming, Martin.
Should he put on,
and,
should he put on
there's
trial?
A general election coming, Martin. And this week we had the speeches from Theresa May and from Jeremy Corbyn about really launching their election campaigns. We haven't got time to listen to all of them, but let's have a go at having listened roughly for the same time, see how they do in the first few minutes of their talk. First of all, to Theresa May, who launched her campaign in York.
Thank you very much, everybody, and it's great to be with you here today in York as we now put the local elections behind us and focus on what Patrick has rightly said is a crucial general election in just 30 days' time. And we must take absolutely nothing for granted. And we're certainly not taking anything for granted when it comes to our team. We've got a great team of candidates here from across the whole of the north of England. And my message, I'm simply saying to people in the north of England, this is the team that I need behind me to be in a strong position to get the best possible deal for Britain from Brexit. This is the team that is going to take our positive message out across communities, across the whole of the north of England. That message about strong and stable leadership in the national interest, about strengthening the UK's position in those Brexit negotiations, about building a better future for Britain. Now, at the weekend, you may have noticed there were French presidential elections, and the new French president, was elected with a strong mandate that will put him in a strong position in the negotiations. So we need a strong mandate to put us in a strong position in those negotiations. And every single vote for my local candidates will strengthen my hand in those Brexit negotiations to get the best deal for Britain. And the alternative is to risk making Jeremy Corbyn Prime Minister. Now just picture him sitting at the negotiating table with the combined might of the European Commission and 27 other European countries ranged against him. And the Liberal Democrats, as Patrick said, the Liberal Democrats, the Scottish Nationalists and others are lining up to prop him up. And a Jeremy Corbyn-led coalition of chaos is a real possibility. We must not let that happen.
So that's the first couple of minutes of Theresa May's opening of her election speech, or the election campaign. Now let's have a listen to the first couple of minutes of Jeremy Corbyn's, see if he does any better.
We have 4 weeks. We have 4 weeks to take our message to the voters, to convince them Britain can be better. It can be transformed. It doesn't have to be like this. We can transform Britain into a country that, instead of being run for the rich, is one where everyone can lead richer lives. And I mean richer in every sense. Richer because all of us have potential to fulfill, family to support, interests to pursue. Richer when that potential that is there in all of us is not held back. Because there is no doubt this country is being held back. If your children aren't getting the education they deserve because the class sizes are too high, then your children are being held back. If you're a young couple or anyone trying to get a home and can't make a home because rent and house prices are too high, then you're being held back. If you've worked hard all your life, but you can't pursue your dreams of your retirement because you're supporting your family well into their adulthood, then you too are being held back. But Britain is a rich country, the sixth richest country in the world. We caught a glimpse of that wealth only 2 days ago when Rupert Murdoch's Sunday Times published its rich list.
Thank you, Jeremy Corbyn, for plugging the way we started the programme here. But let's just make it clear there are other parties running. The Lib Dems did their launch as well. They're hoping to gain dozens of seats with effectively an anti-Brexit campaign. The Greens, too, anti-Brexit pretty much, even though they weren't up till about 10 years ago. But the environment's at the heart of their election campaign. But Kevin, first of all, what do you make of those two speeches?
Well, emotionally, I prefer Jeremy's. It's a pitch to, the better side of people. I don't prefer Theresa May's because it's based on rip-off. And fundamentally, she's not telling a true story.
When you say rip-off, are you referring to this whole... The tax thing and all this.
She ultimately is a prisoner of the forces that allow things like the rich list to occur. You know, she's not going to do anything to stop all the money, that's being stolen out of the NHS. She is a prime minister for the rich.
Well, her husband, Philip May, who was on the One Show, the dreadful One Show, every time I hear that music, if you ever hear it, I always switch the TV off or over or something. But she was on that talking about who puts the bins out. Philip May, Martin, from Capital Group, he's actually one of the big investors in, for example, the pharmaceutical industry.
Yeah.
He is, yeah. I mean, I prefer Jeremy's pitch, if you like, but I'd just like to pick up on what Jeremy May said about mandates. In actual fact, as I've said on this programme many times, the Conservative Party in Britain has never had a mandate. They've never had 50% plus one of the vote. Now, of course, we're now living in referendum land, referendum world, where you've actually got to get 50% plus one. So when she goes to debate or negotiate with Macron, he's got 60%. Putin's United Russia takes about 60% of the vote. And of course, coalitions in the rest of Europe are formed on proportional basis. So every single person at that table will have a mandate. I doubt that she will have a 50% plus one mandate, and she certainly won't have a mandate in Scotland or in Northern Ireland. And of course, the other thing that she's mentioned is this coalition of chaos idea. What is wrong with having a coalition of different forces would actually make a... could you imagine Jeremy Corbyn would actually, when he went to negotiate with the other 27 EU members, he'd probably get a standing ovation as he walked in the room. So it would make it a lot more easy for Britain to get a good deal. Whereas Theresa May's policy of pretending to be Winston Churchill, if she goes into those negotiations with less than 50%, she will be wasted by everybody else who has got a mandate, because she won't have one.
Okay, Mike, just like to give you final chances to plug your meeting next Thursday evening as well. Just can you just give us an idea of, if for those that won't be able to make it, well, first of all, tell us, for those that won't be able to make it, what you'll be talking about, and if you can give us a hint of the sort of things that you'll be telling people.
We'll be talking about the theft of our NHS by Theresa May. We are the sixth wealthiest country in the world. We can afford a properly funded NHS, and we'll explain how that can be delivered. We'll also be talking about the trade deal that's very likely to be made between Theresa May, if she becomes next Prime Minister, and Donald Trump, which will involve the American health massive corporates coming in and taking over UK or English health services, because actually we're talking about England here. And the last thing I would say is that, talking about the chaos and stable and strong, we don't have a stable and strong NHS. People need to realise that, and they need to think about how they're going to vote on June the 8th. And our meeting on Thursday at Trinity Centre at 7:30 will help people think about that.
And that's just opposite Trinity Road Police Station. But there's also the why is the BBC, for example, not telling us about what's going on? Because there's very little information in the national press, particularly about what's happening to the NHS. A few little bits from think tanks and surveys, but not the bigger picture, Mike.
Well, I mean, it's interesting, Tony, because a couple of months ago, I actually wrote to the BBC and complained about their coverage. And their reply was bland, pat, and actually not honest. And it's very difficult to know why. I think there are two or three reasons, very quick. One is that I think the BBC is scared of upsetting the government in power, and especially the Tory government. Secondly, there is not the rigour of analysing facts that I think some of the alternative media is doing, and they're not talking about the facts. And I think third, that people are beginning to realise that, and there's no whole alternative narrative being provided by alternative media, YouTubers, blogs, and so on social media. And I think we have to perhaps say that the BBC has slightly lost the plot on this, and we're sending out a press release for Thursday's meeting to BBC Points West. We'll be asking to have a slot on their programme. We'll see what happens.
Okay, well, the very best of luck. Don't hold your breath, mind you. But there is actually, I mean, it's supposed to be a public service broadcaster, and somebody's brought out a book recently, which is, his name's Professor Tom Mills from Aston University in Birmingham. The book is called BBC, The Myth of Public Service Broadcasting. So let's have a listen to his take on why the BBC has changed so much over the last 30, 40 years and now seems to be aligned with big business rather than serving us who pay the licence fee.
Pockets of critical journalism, particularly investigative reporting, sort of socially conscious news and current affairs, did start to develop under the influence of 60s culture, particularly in the 1970s and 1980s. A lot of that was heavily criticised by the Thatcher government, and a lot of it was rolled back progressively in the late 80s and early 90s, something which was signalled by the departure of Alistair Milne, who was Director General, basically. It marked the beginning of a shift where editorial policy became much more centralised, much more controlled, and the BBC became much more risk averse. So the BBC became much, much more pro-business. It's quite an explicit change that takes place, and it was driven by business orientated leadership. First of all, John Burt and then Red Dyke. John Burt, who was Director General of the BBC during the 1990s, was a neoliberal in, I mean, the narrowest sense of the word. I mean, this isn't really acknowledged in any of the literature, but he used to spend time at the Institute for Economic Affairs, which was, like, for those who don't know, was kind of the seminal Thatcherite neoliberal think tank. He was very close to a guy called Peter Jay, who was an economics editor at the Times, who was very influential in disseminating monetarist thinking in the 1970s. He wrote parts of Callaghan's speech about not being able to spend your way out of a crisis. He introduced an internal market at the BBC, which was modelled on the NHS. And what the initiative of the 1990s, which was very much in the spirit at the time, was about dividing the BBC into buying and selling, buyers and sellers, right? So the BBC would have to, if you were working at the BBC, you have to sell your content to someone else at the BBC, and you trade with each other as part of the much wider neoliberal form of public service. And the reason I mention that is that It fundamentally transformed the culture of the BBC. It became much more entrepreneurial, as they like to say, but much more business-orientated, much more orientated towards costs, and much more integrated into the capitalist marketplace. The exception to that is news and current affairs, and in this area, I mean, there have been cuts and so on, but in any case, a lot of the reporting, as I'm sure we're all familiar, has been done by people drawn from you know, the upper middle class, elite strata, mainly Oxford, Cambridge, privately educated people. This again was part of the shift that took place under John Burt in the 1990s. A very, very elitist reporting patterns.
The media is very central to democracy and how a democracy functions.
So that was Professor Tom Mills there. His book is called BBC, The Myth of Public Service Broadcasting, and we'll hopefully be hearing from him on Dialect in future weeks. Kevin, yeah, I mean, the BBC is supposed to be telling us what's going on. Effectively, it's there more as a lobbying tool of big business, it seems.
Yeah. Well, you don't understand how bad the BBC actually is till you have a specialisation and they get themselves involved. Well, I wrote a book about who owns Britain, and one day I got a phone call from a presenter saying, "Kevin, I've been asked to present a programme about who owns Britain, and it looks terribly like your book." And when I followed this up, it was my book. They had not contacted the publisher, me or anyone, and they had gutted the book, and they hadn't understood it. So they had
so
spent
what effectively they've done is they've done a kind of fake version of your book, in a way.
Well, then,
it's spun in their direction.
Yeah. Then they realised they'd been caught out. You know, they'd been spotted stealing the book, and they offered me a contract as a consultant for the programme they eventually made, and I was the consultant who never consulted. It was a con, and the programme is so bad, they've never been able to show it again. There are fundamental flaws in it.
Okay.
They didn't even establish who legally owns the country.
Which is the Queen, of course, and they didn't say, wouldn't like to say that.
No.
That's Royal Charter, isn't it? Anyway, finally, Bristol Housing Charity tops the list of UK's most prosecuted landlords. A charity set up to house homeless amongst the landlords has been convicted of making money from substandard properties but still letting homes to tenants. The charity is called Alternative Housing, which was established to provide accommodation for homeless people with addiction problems, convicting housing offences 6 times over the past 2 years after letting properties with problems, including overflowing raw sewage. This is in The Guardian, Martin.
Yeah.
Yeah, I understand they've evicted existing tenants in order to get contracts to house homeless people. Welfare scamming, isn't it, really?
Live from the Sky News Centre.